You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. I pulled an interesting one out of the hat for this week's episode, and it's a film that may seem familiar to some of you, and others may not have heard of this movie or have had a chance to see it. It didn't get a lot of television time, but when I saw it, it really grabbed my attention. I saw it in the early 1970s on a television broadcast, and I'm trying to remember exactly where it was I saw it because it was during my college years, and I believe I may have seen it at home during a break during either my sophomore or junior year. Now, the film was made in 1970, but it wasn't released until 1972 by American International Pictures, old AIP, which bought the movie as a tax loss. Now, the reason I say it may be familiar to some of you when I describe the storyline of the film is that it is very, very similar to a couple of movies that we've talked about already here in the last few seasons on Monster Attack. Most of you know that I am a huge fan of Robert Quarry, and I love his character Count Yorga, the vampire. That was a movie that I saw my senior year in high school. It was at a midnight showing. It was a Halloween special thing. We didn't know what the movie was going to be. They kept everybody in suspense. Just it was going to be a special horror film at the Cardinal Theater in Raleigh, North Carolina. I was with a bunch of friends, and when the screen credit came on, that it was Count Yorga, I had heard about this movie. It had quite a reputation at that time, and I was very, very excited, and they didn't know, you know, anything about the movie. And I'm going, oh, this is great. I've been wanting to see this. I've told this story, I know, when I did Count Yorga and also Return of Count Yorga. But so this is a film that I really, really loved. When I saw this movie, I swore that it must have been made by the same people that made Count Yorga, but it wasn't. It was made by an entirely different cast and crew, although I've got to think that they may have been influenced by Count Yorga because the films are so similar. The name of the movie is Death Master. Now, I got to tell you, this film grabbed me so hard. When I saw it on a television broadcast. It wasn't my typical monster movie matinee or chiller theater. It wasn't on Sunrise Theater out of Raleigh. It was an afternoon, I remember, an early Saturday afternoon, like 1 or 2 o'clock. And this film just caught me totally by surprise because I thought, wow, where did this movie come from? One, when I saw it was going to be Robert Quarry in it, I thought maybe it was going to be like another, like a sequel to Count Yorga Vampire, because it was around 1974 or so that I saw this film for the first time. But I was just very delighted in it. It was so much like Count Yorga, taking the vampire legend, putting it into a contemporary setting. This time, it's really a hippie-type setting, which made it a lot more fun. It took place all around California. In fact, they shot some of this on Malibu Beach, which was they used the very same part of Malibu Beach that Roger Corman many years earlier had used for Attack of the Crab Monsters. So some of that looked very familiar, and you see it in the very beginning of the film. But we'll get into all of the details in just a moment. The rest of it was shot, a good part of it, at Topanga Canyon. I think I'm saying that right, or is it Topanga? Well, either way, if you're from California, you can correct me. There's an old country store there that's right there off the beach, and it sets up in the movie as sort of a hangout for all the hippie kids. So they shot a lot there. And then again, at another part of Los Angeles, out in the rural part of Los Angeles, a really unique house out there. I won't call it a mansion, but just a nice big house sitting up on a hill, on a big hill, where they shot a lot of interior scenes there. So everything was shot on location. Nothing was shot in a studio for this particular production, and it deals with an old-world vampire coming into Los Angeles, into the Los Angeles area, among this commune of kids, trying to enact his ways with them. Now, I will say that I'm going to spoil everything about this. I always warn everybody on the podcast that when I talk about these films and the influence they have on me, I can't help but spoil them in just about every way. So if you've not seen Death Master, you may not want to listen to the podcast. I think even if you hear the podcast first and watch Death Master, you'll still have a lot of fun with it, even with me spoiling it all. Because it goes into the whole thing that I've talked about a lot about movies from the 70s. And I got to tell you, folks, I'm gonna just go off on a tangent here a little bit, and I've know I've mentioned this before in other episodes, but it was such a defining time period for me. I'm in my formative years during this year, you know, during 1970 to 1974, 5, 6, around there. You know, that's high school and college years, and you know, this is where I formed a lot of my attitudes and a lot of my beliefs and some of my philosophy. And if you weren't alive during this time period, just bear with me a little bit. And those of you who were, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. This was a very idealistic time for us. I mean, we were still involved in the Vietnam War. That would not wrap up until around 1973. We were the generation that was suspicious of the government. We were patriotic, and we loved the United States. And we loved the flag, in spite of some things that you might see in movies. But we started questioning things. And we started questioning what we saw as contradictions, things that political figures were telling us that didn't make sense, or they would contradict themselves on the same subject. And we would question them. So we became those kids that were radicals. And, you know, and then the whole hippie thing, you know, we grew our hair long. I look back on some of the pictures of me with the long hair and stuff, and it makes me laugh. Now, in high school, I kept it pretty closely cropped. I was playing sports, and so, you know, I was a good little boy. But then when I get to college, boy, I let it go. You know, and then I eventually grew a beard and all that, and had a beard right up until the early 1980s. So, you know, we were the radicals, you know, hair down to our shoulders. I remember Dad always saying, you know, especially when I was in college, you need to get a haircut. You know, you need to get a haircut. You're not going to get anywhere without that. But that's who we were. And we got very philosophical. This was a time period where you started questioning a lot of things. And the lifestyle of Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best, you know, and the Donna Reed Show and stuff, we started questioning how important that really was. Is that all that there was in life, was just to go to college, get a job 9 to 5, get married, have kids, have the house and the white picket fence? For a lot of people I went to school with, it was. And then for some of us, I was a little more bohemian. You know, I was a little more into the artistic scene. And it took me a while to really come out of my shell, because I was sort of insecure, especially in high school. Although I was an extrovert, I did that to cover up my you know, the fact that I really was an introvert, which is very true. So I was into acting and that sort of thing, and in that artistic endeavor. And it took me a while really to not be afraid to show that and let people know that's really what I was into. But it also was a time where we started questioning our belief system. That maybe, you know, maybe religion wasn't the answer. Maybe it was. We weren't sure. So we started exploring other philosophies and things. And that all plays into this movie. That's the only reason I'm getting off on this tangent, because it is a very, very important part of this movie. You know, the whole hippie movement, a lot of it had to do with questioning who you were, you know, not being defined by the traditional, but really looking into yourself and exploring yourself and trying to find who the true you was. And some of us took us forever. It took us forever to find that. And some of us fought what we discovered was our true selves. And some of us found it and lived very happily ever after. Took me a long time to really come around because I was so afraid of what people might think of me or my family or things. So I was very much a people pleaser during those days. But this all comes to play very much in this film, the philosophical musings of Robert Quarry's character. Now, he plays a character in this movie by the name of Korda. You know, I didn't think about it. Count Yorga, Korda. Yeah, this is going to be one of the similarities that I find between these two films. Now, Count Yorga was made first. So Quarry had already done Count Yorga when he did this. He's an associate producer here on Death Master. And one of the other tie-ins to Count Yorga was that Korda is a vampire in this film. And Quarry used his own teeth. Oh, his own vampire teeth that he used in Count Yorga, because they had been, if you remember from the episode I've mentioned, he had them custom fitted by a dentist, so they fit him perfectly. And if you look at all of the vampire films from the 70s and before, you've got it. You'll admit that the vampire fangs that Quarry had for the Count Yorga films and for this one were just outstanding because they were custom made. It influenced me, I know, when I directed Dracula, and I mentioned to you guys a while back that I had directed an in-the-round version, a dinner theater in-the-round version, the same production that Bela Lugosi appeared in, that version of Dracula that the movie was based on. And I had a dentist fit my Dracula with custom-made teeth as well, because we wanted it to look good. You know, we didn't want to look like just some plastic teeth that you throw in and have fangs. So that is one thing that Quarry carried over, and I think, you know, he was drawn to this. I think I believe that the director Ray Danton, who was an actor in Hollywood and in circles, he knew Quarry, probably had Quarry all in mind for this role because he is absolutely perfect for this role as the vampire who comes across to a bunch of kids in a commune as a big philosopher and one who has all of the answers. He's almost portrayed as a Jesus-like figure. Now, before I get anybody offended, let me say it's because of the way they have him dressed. He's in sandals. He's in long flowing robes. He's got the beard and the long hair. And, you know, first look at him, wow, yeah, he's sort of, you know, they're trying to make this character resemble Jesus or something. Or that's how these kids take him. It's like, wow, he really knows it all. And he comes off spouting a lot of philosophical mumbo jumbo, basically. But it's, you know, these kids eat it all up. And on an interesting note, Robert Quarry ad-libbed many of those scenes. Not the whole movie, but just where he is spouting his philosophy. They just, Ray Danton just turned him loose. Now, this is Ray's first job as a director. And up until this point, he had been acting in Hollywood pretty regularly, a lot of television stuff and in small independent films, but for nearly 20 years, and decided to try his hand at directing. And he went on to form his own production company and direct three other films. In fact, he directed a couple of them in Italy and in Spain as well, and had quite a career for as long as he was around. He left us at an early age. He was only 60 years old when he died of an infection, and you have to wonder, you know, how much farther he could have gone. He had more than 100 credits, 117 to date, acted right up until 1977. At the age of 92, I should say, he acted until 1977, and then he got behind the camera and started producing and directing. But, you know, in 1992, he passes away from this infection. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe it was a kidney infection that killed him. And so we lost him. It would have been interesting to see what else he might have come up with, because I think as far as a directing goes for this being his debut, I'm going to say this, folks, and you may disagree with me. I think he did an excellent job. He gets some fantastic performances out of a lot of people that had never acted much before. There's going to be a lot of folks in here who, like Bill Ewing and Brenda Dixon, who play sort of our male and female leads in the film. They're the young couple who, they come under the influence of Korda and are a little disturbed by, Bill Ewing's character, Pico, is a little disturbed by the influence Korda is having on the rest of the gang, of this commune that he hangs out with. Now, Bill Ewing would go on to do a lot of TV and some independent film work, and have a very successful career. He did pretty well in the industry. Went on to become a pretty well known producer, director, and writer. And worked on a lot of big films. So, and he's still around. I don't know if he's still involved with the business, but he's still hanging around. Does a passable job in this. He does pretty well. He is the wide-eyed kid. They play him like he may be a Native American. The way they do his hair, and he wears the headband and stuff. And the first thing I thought when I saw this film was Billy Jack. And if any of you are familiar with the movie Billy Jack, that was a film that really made an impact on my generation. Huge, huge impact. It was a massive cult hit in the early 1970s. And Billy Jack was a Native American who knew Kung Fu and all this. And Bill Ewing's character in this, Pico, is also a young Native American who knows Kung Fu. And again, this was around the time that the television show Kung Fu was being thought of, and Bruce Lee was gaining a reputation. Martial arts was becoming more and more popular, and so this became something that you would see thrown into a lot of these independent films. Now, it is a low budget independent film, but it was shot for $110,000, which is not bad. Not bad. And folks, I got to tell you, looking at this movie, it does not look like a $110,000 film. It doesn't. So again, and I pay tribute to Ray Danton on that one. I think this film was shot so well. The copy of it that I have now was one that was restored to digital quality because originally you could only find this on VHS. A couple of horror collections. Elvira has one, or she actually showed it on her TV show, and then it made it into one of her collections. And a couple other trash of cinemas. Remember those, the VHS releases of all the drive-in and schlocky type horror and monster movies, on these compilations. So up until then, and then the version I saw on television, was, I won't say a rough copy, but it had the dirt on it, and sometimes the little marks and stuff like that. It was an old film, probably an old 16 millimeter film that they showed on the show that I saw, because that's usually what they used for the film chains for TV stations back then. And this was a local station that showed it, a local type of movie show. The only thing that I was a little disappointed with is that it is not available. Deathmaster right now is not available on a streaming service. And I hope that changes. So you might have to look a little bit to find it. It's possible that it could be out there on YouTube. I'm not sure about that. I should have looked into that before I did the show. But, if you really want to see this movie, and I think you ought to check it out. I think if anything, nostalgia-wise, it's a very interesting film. You're going to have to look a little hard for it. You might have to work at this one. This is not going to be readily available, but I do hope you find a good copy of it, because I think it's a very entertaining film, and I think for nearly an hour and a half, it runs just a little under an hour and a half. It's a pretty interesting film. Now let's talk real quickly about Brenda Dixon, who is the female co-star in this, and she plays Pico's girlfriend. And of course, that's established very early on in the movie. And, you know, they have a little love-hate thing going on, but it's all kidding, you know, the kidding around type of thing. Brenda Dixon didn't act a whole lot, but she made a name for herself near the end of her career, the final 14 years of her acting career, appearing in The Young and the Restless. And she played Jill Abbott. Now, if anybody out there is a soap opera fan, and The Young and the Restless was one of your favorite soap operas, when I was in school, when I was in college, that and All My Children were the two big, hot soap operas. I actually knew guys who got into this. People would run down to the student union at noon, or between noontime and 2 o'clock in the afternoon every single weekday to go check out one of those two shows. I think one came out at 1, and I think Young and Restless came on right after that, or it may have been vice versa or whatever. I never got into soap operas, folks, except for Dark Shadows. It's the only one that I got into. But she was the apparently the big villainess in The Young and the Restless, and there are many soap opera fans and some people in the industry who attribute Brenda and her character of Jill Abbott for being the character that kept The Young and the Restless a success. On an ironic note, in 1988, I think it was ABC TV, if I'm not mistaken, that had The Young and the Restless. They fired her. They fired her from the show. It really surprised everybody because within a few weeks after she got fired, she won a major Daytime Emmy Award for playing Jill Abbott. And she was a class act all the way. And at her acceptance speech, you know, she didn't make any catty remarks or anything. She thanked all of the people who were fans of the show and the people on the show for giving her an opportunity for 14 years to play this character. She was in nearly 200 episodes of the TV show and walks away with a Daytime Emmy as a result. She also appeared on Falcon Crest, the nighttime soap opera, just one time as Tony's girlfriend in one of the 1983 episodes. So, you know, she was into these, you know, she did Love American Style. I guess it's not a soap opera, but that was sort of an anthology show. She was a love expert in that, and as the sexpert and stuff. And you know, appeared a couple of other TV shows like the FBI and others that wouldn't be too familiar to you. So this was like one of her big moments, this film. And she does, you know, she does a pretty good job. She plays Rona, and Rona captures the eye of Corda. You know, every vampire in every vampire movie is going to get have his eyes set on one of the females in the movie. And you know, Rona, very pretty gal, long hair. You know, this was something about the 70s. I loved the styles, the long hair styles. The svelte figures, I loved the you know, even though I look back now and sort of laugh at some of the things we dressed in, it's still very appealing to me. I wish it would come back, although now I'm too old to wear that stuff. It'd be sort of laughable. But yes, I had the hippie jeans that were multicolored, you know, like multi-striped colored. They were bell bottoms. You know, I had special shoes that weren't, you know, they were like shoe boots and that sort of thing, or big buckles on them and things. And I had the paisley shirts, you know, all that went along with it. And, you know, I would wear a headband when I played soccer or basketball, that sort of, you know, all of the things that were with hippies. I look at pictures of my sister, who was 2 years younger than me, and some of the things, some of the vest that she wore, some of the jewelry that, you know, more, I would call it organic jewelry, you might say, you know, some of the big necklaces they wore and things of that nature. And this movie brings back a lot of fond memories of girls I had crushes on in high school and college and things. And it was an interesting time period. Yes, we were very ideological. We weren't very practical. And again, a lot of the people that I grew up with that were into that scene ended up becoming, you know, just regular, ordinary people after a while. We weren't the horrific radicals that our parents' generation might have thought we were. We scared a lot of people. But we were very idealistic. We were against apathy. We wanted to be involved politically and socially in all of that. And that all comes into play in the movie. I'm going to mention one other character who's in this. And, you know, every low-budget independent film has what I call a ringer. You know, you want to put one guy in there who's a recognizable star, a recognizable actor. And sometimes, you know, when I tell you who the ringers are, you might say, well, really, they weren't that big, were they? Well, it just depends. You know, if it's somebody that's recognizable, that's usually good enough for a small independent film. This guy's a great character actor. He was a terrific character actor. We lost him in 2005 at the age of 80. But he appeared in more than 200 productions of TV and movies. He also did some voiceover work. If you were to hear him talk and not see him, you would know exactly who he was. But you might not know his name. His name is John Fiedler. And he was in virtually every television show that I can think of from the 60s up through the 80s. From, you know, The Odd Couple. He appeared on Broadway. He did the voice of Piglet in Winnie the Pooh. He was in True Grit. He was in a lot of Westerns. He would show up in that, you know, little bald-haired guy, bald-headed guy. I always say that bald-haired. Is how can he be bald in here? Yeah, you know, but a little bald-headed guy, you know, had the little spare tire around there of hair around the side of his head, would wear glasses, a little short guy, had a very high-pitched voice, would sometimes play a very naive type of person. In the movie 12 Angry Men, one of my favorite movies, you know, he was one of the jurors who, he was sort of naive. You know, maybe the guy wasn't guilty or not when everybody thought he was guilty. You know, he always played that kind of nice guy, nice older guy that would live next door to you. And things. And in this, he plays a owner of this general store that all the kids hang out at. And, you know, he just goes by the name of Pop. And it's Pop's, you know, Pop's get-together or whatever. I can't even remember the store's actual physical name. But he would make jewelry, you know, handmade jewelry and that sort of thing. And, of course, there's one character who comments about how expensive it is in there, you know, and he had snacks and food. And so it doubled up as a grocery store or a fat, you know, it was more than a convenience store, you know, a little bigger than a more like the neighborhood groceries that popped up around my neighborhood in upstate New York. They're still up there. You know, it's like families had, you know, these little grocery stores and they would live up top of the building. My great uncle had one just down the street from where I was pretty much raised. You know, it was just a little two-story house that the bottom of it was a grocery store, a little family grocery store, and then he lived upstairs. So, you know, that was Pops, you know, and everybody, you know, they hung out for Pops. They would ask him for advice. You know, he didn't look down on the kids, and he sort of dressed like they did too and didn't look dumb doing it. You know, so he was, you know, in their mind, he was sort of hip and, you know, but he did have a little bit of experience that they could draw off of. The kids in this are all sort of portrayed as maybe just out of high school or, you know, early college age, and maybe some might be young enough to be still in high school. And let's go ahead and just get to the storyline. We get kicked in the pants right off early. And this is where it reminds me a great deal of Count Yorga Vampire. Because you remember in that movie, it starts off in the Daleks. And we've got, you know, we had Count Yorga's accolade, you know, the big tall guy, picking up this big box and things and putting it on a big pickup truck, coming off a ship and then driving off into downtown San Francisco. Well, here is a little more mysterious, a little more spooky because you're on Malibu Beach, and we see this guy who the character's name is Barbado. He's played by an actor by the name of Lassane Hilton, and Lassane didn't do a whole lot. He didn't do much acting. He doesn't speak in this. I'll tell you what, though, I'm going to say as an actor in this film, He's very believable. This is the only movie that I'm aware of that he ever made. Yeah, the only movie, but he really pulls his character off. His eyes, he has to play it all with his eyes and his face. And he looks like he's probably from the islands. You know, like a voodoo type guy. He's got the big afro and all that. And he comes walking up to this cliff on the beach. And he pulls out, he's got a little bag, and he pulls out this cup, and he pulls out, we don't know what it is. Maybe it's ashes of the vampire. You never really know. And then he pulls out a pan flute and starts playing a very mysterious, very, very mysterious melody, which is very similar to the one played in the beginning of Count Yorga. Like I said, I think there's a lot of influence on these two with one another. And all of a sudden, a coffin comes floating into the shore. And this surfer guy is running down the beach, and he sees it, and he pulls the coffin, you know, up onto the sand. And, of course, what does he do? He opens it up. Well, that's not a good move, because as he opens it up, Barbado is there and takes him out. And then he loads the coffin up on a pickup truck that he has nearby and drives off. So very similar openings to the film. So now we've established there is a vampire. We haven't met Robert Quarry yet, but we know that there is a vampire there, because who else would be in a coffin that somebody would pick up like this? And then we cut to Pop's place. And there's a motorcycle gang that pulls in there, and they figure, oh boy, this is going to be trouble, because you got all the hippie kids floating around, and there's this motorcycle gang, and this main guy, Monk, is the character's name, played by William Jordan. William actually did a lot of TV after this film. So, you know, he was around for quite a while and did a lot of TV shows. Might look familiar to some of you when you see this film. And he and Pop have sort of, they go at it a little bit about, you know, how much Pop is charging for this really nice necklace. $28, you're charging people too much and all this stuff. And, of course, Pico hears all this, and he says, hey, leave the guy alone. Because, Monk is a brute type. He grabs Pop, and I ought to smash you. And then Pico says, no, leave him alone. And then, of course, you know, Pico is a lot smaller than Monk. And then they square off, and, of course, Pico gets him because he knows kung fu. And he takes him out. Of course, the local cop shows up, and they all take off scattering. You've got Pico and Rona's girlfriend, and you've got Monk and his girlfriend, who is known as Eslin. And they're all hiding out in the woods next to the beach, looking out. And then the guy goes, yeah, what was that you did to me? And he goes, it's kung fu. And he goes, wow, geez. You know, and then he's just worried about getting his bike back while things die down. And Rona goes, why don't you just have dinner with us? You know, we're just going to, you know, the gang's going to be at our house, and we're just going to all have dinner. Well, she doesn't say it's a commune. We don't know that till we get there. Now, they use a really cool house in the rural, like I said, in the rural part of the beach part of Los Angeles, up on a big hill. It's hard to describe this house. From the inside and the outside, just a really cool looking house. I don't know much about it, and I wish I could have found out more about it, because it's a great location. And you basically got all these hippie kids hanging out there. Now, we don't know how they got there. There's electricity in the house, so it must belong to somebody. They're just sort of, I don't think they're house sitting. There's just no telling. Maybe some rich guy owns it, doesn't even know they're there, but they've apparently been there for a while. As things, you know, as we see Monk sort of, you know, getting drunk on beer and trying to figure out, these crazy kids, we're going to take off so we can get out of here and all this stuff. All of a sudden, this mysterious figure shows up, and we only see him in the shadows. We don't see his face. And he starts spouting philosophy. And this is Robert Quarry. This is Corda. And he almost makes it sound like this is his house. And he gives him he wets their whistle, so to speak. You know, all these kids are in their way. We're really digging what you're saying here in all this. And again, get over the language. That's how people really talked back then in these circles. And so, yeah, we're really digging what you're saying in all this. And we want to learn more. We want you to teach us. and he just sort of smiles, as only Robert Quarry can do, because now he knows he's got him on the hook. And he wanders off, and he just dissolves into the far wall. And then Barbado follows, but he goes around into a door and follows up because he's human. So now we've established that, yeah, Korda, he's got something really sort of ethereal going on here, you know, something really unique about him. And he slowly develops a rapport with these kids where they hang on his every word, even Pico originally. But he gets a little concerned about the influence he has on him. Now, I'm not going to give you a play-by-play of the storyline, just to say that little by little, Korda starts taking over these kids. Now, what I mean by taking over, he starts with Eslin. He gets his sights on her. She's a little older than the others, but still very attractive. And there's some great, great spooky moments in here, where through using music, he gets them dancing, and he gets them all riled up. You know, and again, some folks may be offended by what I said, but like some of these televangelists do, how they can get people really riled up with music and chanting and things like that. But this is all like voodoo chanting and that sort of thing. And these kids are really getting into what they're feeling. They're almost feeling like power. And that's what he's trying to get them to tap into. And this is the beginning of a cult. Now, you've got to keep in mind, you know, in 1970, 1972, when this was released, you know, there were cults around, but they weren't as well known as we know them now. You know, things like Jonestown and things like that. You know, we didn't, you know, these were still far off by several years. You know, Jonestown wouldn't occur until 1979. But they were around. We just didn't know about them. I was aware of a couple of big religious cults in the United States. But that was about it. We didn't really understand it. And we never really understood how easy it would be to come under the influence of a cult. So that plays heavily into this. Pico sort of sees this happening, and he's bothered by it. And then he's beginning to realize, little by little, by some things that he puts two and two together, that they're dealing with a vampire. Because there's some strange things happening, like some people die, like Monk goes, he dies, and a couple of the girls die, and they all have marks on their neck. And Pico starts putting it together. Now, Rona sort of comes under the influence of Korda, but she's not a vampire per se. But we do find out that the others are becoming vampires. We see it. You know, they go through an acolyte stage where they can walk in sunlight. In all of that, but they eventually convert all the way. You know, it's a slow conversion. So Pico reaches out to Pop, basically, to see what they can, you know, if he can help him. Now, they actually get a cop to come visit the commune and talk to Korda and all that after Monk's body is found. But the cops can't make anything of it. You know, they don't see anything that they can charge anybody with. Just, you know, there's no real suspects there. So Pico knows he's on his own, and he and Pops, again, this is just like in Count Yorga, where you've got the guy who's the boyfriend of the main girl that Count Yorga had his eyes on, enlists the help of the doctor to help him fight the vampire, except the doctor's the one that inspires, you know, that gets it going, he incites it. In this one, it's Pico. And Philo does come along and realize that he is a vampire, that Korda is a vampire. Now, of course, they make, you know, all of the mistakes you can possibly make. You know, the vampire can't be out in sunlight and all that, sleeps during the day. Of course, you've got Barbado guarding him as well, and he's no guy to mess around with. But so they always come at night. They always go at night to try to kill him, and they realize all the kids are... They've all become vampires now because they're all being attacked by him. Pico is able to get away, and he and Pops get separated. But Pico gets a bead on Korda. He sees him slip into this room. There's this wonderful, and this must be part of the actual house because they didn't go into a studio for this. There's like these caverns underneath this house. You know, they've tunneled out these caves. And this tunnel underneath with rooms off of it. I don't know, maybe there were bomb shelters used as bomb shelters or something of that nature? Could have been, because after the Cold War, that was a fear of people. People had that fear in World War II that the Japanese might bomb Los Angeles. So, you know, but they're really cool, spooky looking things. I could see why Ray Danton wanted this place as a location. You know, there are doors there that are like the kind of doors you would find in a ship, you know, metal type hatches or whatever, you know, the big hatches you would see that would connect rooms in a ship and that sort of thing. So it just gives it a really odd look. But Pico sees Korda going into one of these rooms, and he's got a stake that he's carved. And he races in there, and he sees the coffin. He finds the coffin. Spoilers coming up here, folks, because I'm really cutting to the chase here as we're running out of time. And he rams it right through the coffin. He doesn't even open the coffin up, doesn't risk that. Just rams it through, and you hear this, oh! And then, of course, can you guess what happens? He opens up the coffin, and it's Pops. He's just rammed this thing through Pops. Now, he had broken it off when it wouldn't go any farther. So he's still got a part there. And then here's Quarry. This is the thing I loved about Quarry's vampires, whether it was Korda or Count Yorga, when he would have the final confrontation with the hero. That laugh, and I know I mentioned it not only in the Count Yorga episode, but in the Return of the Count Yorga, that laugh is like nothing I'd ever heard in a movie. And so, you know, when I saw that this, you know, Deathmaster was going to, with York, I was hoping, you know, with Quarry and all that, he was going to do that again. And then, so when that part of the movie came at the end here, oh my God, it was great. It's a laugh that makes your skin crawl. It just makes your skin crawl. And he has this confrontation, and through scrambling around and struggling with Korda, he manages to have Korda fall on a stake, and he destroys him. Of course, you know, Korda just dissolves into dust. But now he heads upstairs to get his girlfriend, Rona, who up until this point we had seen just before he has the final confrontation with Korda, Rona is being indoctrinated into the cult officially. You know, she's laid out, you know, on a big table, you know, big, it's going to be a big ceremony and all of that. So, you know, maybe he can save her. And he gets up there, and everyone is dead. All of the kids are dead. They're all dust because he killed the main vampire. There was a connection. But Rona's still there. And he runs up to her. She's still laying there. And he says, please, please, you can't be one of these. You can't be one of these. And as he's talking, very good effect. Very, very good effect watching her slowly age, and then turning into dust. And the movie ends. Now, you might remember I mentioned so many times I've talked about movies from this time period that I really believe that it was just illegal to let an independent film from this time period have a happy ending. Of course, none of the two Yorga ones did not have a happy ending. And then this one doesn't either. Of course, this is a one. Now, they didn't use the same gag that Yorga did where the girlfriend comes attacking the hero at the end. No, in this one, everyone's dead. All of the vampires are totally gone, and Pico is the only one who survives. Even Pop is gone. It's just Pico all by himself at the end. Because there's never any real winners in a true vampire movie. And that's the message that came out of Deathmaster. And I like that so much better than what some vampire movies have become nowadays. Again, I know I rag on them a lot, but this whole Byron-esque, you know, the vampire is a romantic victim. And I hate that. No, the vampire's a monster. And in this movie, the vampires are monsters. This is a real gem, folks. Now, Roger Ebert hated this movie. I'm not sure why, because he liked Count Yorga. I remember when he and Siskel and Ebert both talked about Count Yorga, they liked it. But he hated this. He put it on his most hated list. And mentioned it on a couple of occasions, just how much he did not like this movie. And I don't know why. He said, folks, you know, maybe I'm too soft on these movies, but I think it was directed extremely well. It was shot beautifully. It was edited beautifully. There's a lot to like about this film. And even, you know, again, the acting is pretty good in this. Because kids and stuff were really like this back then. So some people say, oh, God, it was they're so dorky and all that. They talk all this, you know, kumbaya stuff. But that's how it was. And it wasn't, they didn't do it phony in this. And that's one thing I liked about it. And that's one thing I liked about Count Yorga was the people that were represented in that weren't phony at all. I think it's worth a shot. If you can get a hold of a copy of Death Master, please do. And check it out. Even if you've listened to the whole podcast and you know all the spoilers. It's a lot of fun for an hour and 24 minutes. It really is. And I tip my hat to these guys. AIP, you know, they booked this film. They had no intention of making any money off of it. I couldn't find any box office figures on it at all. I don't even know if it played in a theater. And I mean, it may have played in some midnight shows down the road, but I don't know. There's absolutely nothing available out there of that kind of information, all that. I mean, I was lucky to find that it was a $110,000 budget. But, yeah, AIP didn't care if they lost money or not. On IMDb, viewers gave it a 5.2 rating out of 10. I think that's a little harsh. I think it's a better film than that. I think it's more like a 7. But if you can get a hold of a copy, see what you think and let me know. Death Master from 1972. It is one of my favorite vampire films, along with the Count Yorga. I sort of lump them all together because they just remind me so much alike. And I think it's the time period more than maybe one didn't influence the other. Maybe it was just more of a reflection of the way things were back then in that time. But a lot of fun. Check it out, folks. I hope you enjoy it. We'll see you again next Monday with an all-new episode of Monster Attack. And we're keeping our fingers crossed. For those of you that voted for us, thank you so much for voting for us in the Rondo Hatton Awards. It'll be a little while before we hear the results of that. But we appreciate all the support you've shown us. We've had a couple of incredible months for listenership, and we're still growing. Thank you so much, folks, for everything and sticking by us for these 6+ years. And have a great week. See you on Monday.
At the 42cast, we want to bring you everything. And that's why we've jam-packed the next few months with as much as we can. You not only get the same reviews, topics, and interviews that you did before, you also get screen reads, where we compare a movie to its source material, or role models, where we talk about tabletop gaming. It's never been a more exciting time to check out our show. It's your ultimate answer to fandom, geekiness, and everything, so why not check it out? We can be found on most podcasting platforms, and we are a proud member of the ESO Network.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.